Our reading is from Acts 2, page 1032 of the Church Bible, and I'll be reading to you the edited highlights. When the day of Pentecost came, they were all together in one place. Suddenly, a sound like the blowing of a violent wind came from heaven and filled the whole house where they were sitting. They saw what seemed to be tongues of fire that separated and came to rest on each of them. All of them were filled with the Holy Spirit and began to speak in other tongues as the Spirit enabled them. Now they were staying in Jerusalem, God-fearing Jews from every nation under heaven. When they heard this sound, a crowd came together in bewilderment because each one heard their own language being spoken. Utterly amazed, they asked, "Aren't all these who are speaking Galileans? Then how is it that each of us hears them declaring the wonders of God in our own native languages?" Amazed and perplexed, they asked one another, "What does this mean?" Then Peter stood up with the 11, raised his voice and addressed the crowd. "Fellow Jews and all of you who live in Jerusalem, let me explain this to you. Listen carefully to what I say. Jesus of Nazareth was a man accredited by God to you by miracles, wonders, and signs, which God did among you through him, as you yourselves know. This man was handed over to you by God's deliberate plan and foreknowledge, and you, with the help of wicked men, put him to death by nailing him to the cross. But God raised him from the dead, freeing him from the agony of death, because it was impossible for death to keep its hold on him. Therefore, let all Israel be assured of this. God has made this Jesus, whom you crucified, both Lord and Messiah." When the people heard this, they were cut to the heart and said to Peter and the other apostles, "Brothers, what shall we do?" Peter replied, "Repent and be baptized, every one of you, in the name of Jesus Christ for the forgiveness of your sins, and you will receive the gift of the Holy Spirit. The promise is for you and your children, and for all who are far off, for all whom the Lord our God will call." With many other words he warned them, and he pleaded with them, "Save yourselves from this corrupt generation." Those who accepted his message were baptized, and about 3,000 were added to their number that day. They devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching and to fellowship, to the breaking of bread and to prayer. Everyone was filled with awe at the many wonders and signs performed by the apostles. All the believers were brought together and had everything in common. They sold property and possessions to give to anyone who had need. Every day they continued to meet in their temple in the courts. They broke bread in their homes and ate together with glad and sincere hearts, praising God and enjoying the favor of all the people. And the Lord added to their number daily those who were being saved.
Thank you, Paul, for reading that passage to us. Slightly longer than some of our usual Bible readings, but I thought it was a good idea on this Sunday when we're celebrating the 100th anniversary of this building to remind ourselves that the Church of Jesus Christ goes back much further than 100 years. It goes right back 2,000 years to the day of Pentecost. And it's good to be reminded of that. Now, every now and then, those of you who've been around for a while, you will know that I like to begin my sermon with a little bit of a trivia question, just to see how well informed you are on some matters of trivia. So I've got a question for you this morning, and it's for those of you who are old enough to remember TV ads in the 1990s. Now, I know for some of you, you probably weren't born in the 1990s and it's ancient history, but there's a possibility that some of you may remember. Because in the 1990s, the Prudential ran a series of adverts on television encouraging people to think about personal pension schemes. And one of the adverts that they ran featured a young couple expressing something of their hopes for retirement. And it included a phrase which at the time became a bit of a catchphrase. So I want to see if you can tell me what that phrase was. And to help you, we're going to watch the first part of the advert, and then it will stop. And then I want to see if you can tell me what was said next. because it's what was said next that was a little phrase that just sort of came into popular use at that time. So this is a young couple expressing their hopes for what they want to do in retirement, and the difference between them is quite interesting to watch. So let's see the first part of the Prudential advert from the 1990s. Line, wasn't it, that came out, "We want to be together." So how does that Prudential advert relate to the Bible passage that we read a moment ago? Well, hold that question in your mind as we just back up for a moment and then come at it again from a slightly different angle. If you've been around St. Barnabas for any length of time, or if you've been around other churches like St. Barnabas for any length of time, one of the phrases that you will have heard used is that we talk about the fact that we believe that it is possible for people to have a personal relationship with God. That's the type of phrase that you will have heard used, a personal relationship with God. And depending on which type of church you're moving, they may well have booklets that they could give to people with titles such as Knowing God Personally, or the question, Would You Like to Know God Personally? And it's something that we believe in. We passionately believe that it is a part of the new covenant that God has made with people, that we can have this personal relationship, as it's expressed in the New Testament in Hebrews, they will all know me, from the least of them to the greatest, for I will forgive their wickedness and will remember their sins no more. We believe it to be true that because of what Jesus did when he died on the cross, you and I can know that our sins are forgiven and we can know God personally. Now, if that is news to you, I hope it is good news to you, because it is the best news ever. And if that is something that you listen to and think, well, I don't really know what that means, to know God personally, then before the morning is out, we would love to have the opportunity to share with you how you can know God personally. So if that's the situation that you're in today, please, before you leave this morning, come and talk to one of us and ask us that question: how can I know God personally? But what I found is this, that some people, when they use the word personal to describe their relationship with God, when they talk about having this personal relationship with God, they mean something different from what I mean. And I think they mean something different from what the New Testament teaches about the relationship that we have with God. I find that some people, when they talk about having a personal relationship with God, what they mean is that they have a private relationship with God. It's a relationship with God that they have no intention of telling anyone else about. It's private to them. They're not going to talk about it because it's private. Some people would go even further. They really don't want anyone to know about their relationship with God. It's not just that they would never tell anyone, they would do everything in their power to hide it from people. And so for them, when they say they've got a personal relationship, it's not just private, it's positively secret. It's a secret relationship with God that they would do their best to hide from other people. They wouldn't want other people to know about it. And then there are some others. And when they talk about having a personal relationship with God, they mean something else. They mean this, that there is a solitary relationship with God. They don't mind other people knowing about their faith. They just don't want to engage with anyone else who might happen to share their same faith. It's personal. For them, that means it's solitary. That's the sort of person who might say things like, well, I never go to church because I don't need to go to church. I don't need to mix with other believers because my faith is a very personal thing. But what they mean is it's a solitary thing. Now, I believe, and we believe, that the Bible teaches that we can have a personal relationship with God. But I don't think that means a private relationship with God where we never tell anyone. I don't think it means a secret relationship with God where we hide it from other people. And it certainly doesn't mean a solitary relationship with God where no one else is involved in that with us. Because when we read the passage that we had read to us a moment ago by Paul from Acts chapter 2, we see that none of those things were true. It certainly wasn't a private thing, because every day they continued to meet in the temple courts, which was a very public place. So their faith was personal, but it wasn't private, it was public. And it certainly wasn't secret, because Peter stood up so that he could be seen, raised his voice so that he could be heard, and addressed the crowd so that everyone knew. There was nothing secret about their relationship with God. And it most definitely was not solitary. Because there's one word that is repeated at least four times in the passage that Paul read for us. And it is, of course, exactly the same word that the Prudential used in their ad. It is this key word, together. The passage in Acts chapter 2 begins, doesn't it, with them all gathered together in one place. And after Peter had preached and about 3,000 people had been added to their number, we read that all the believers were together and had everything in common. Just a moment later, we read that every day they continued to meet together. And then we're told that they ate together with glad and sincere hearts. You just cannot escape the fact that these first followers of Jesus did life together. Now, if you've looked at your bulletin, you'll have seen that the title that has been given to this morning's sermon is What and Why is the Church? And I think the simple answer to the first of those questions, what is the church? The simple answer is this. It is followers of Jesus doing life together. That's what church is. It's us as the people of God doing life together. It's about the together element of being a follower of Jesus. We're celebrating 100 years anniversary of the building, but you do not need me to tell you, this building is not the church. This is the building where the church meets. And what we're celebrating today is not just the fact that this building has been standing for 100 years, though the fact that the gaffer tape is still holding it together is really something that is worth celebrating. Where would we be without Dave and his gaffer tape holding the building together? It's just about holding together, and we can celebrate that, but what we're really celebrating is the fact that the church has met together in this building for 100 years. As that photo montage that we watched said, celebrating 100 years of a building is great, but celebrating 100 years of people is even better. And I know that some folks who used to worship at St. Bede's who've moved away were planning on coming back today for this centenary service, for this anniversary, and that's why it's great to have you here, because that's what the celebration is really all about. It's about the people who have worshipped here over the past 100 years. It's about you and all the other people who have met together in this building over 100 years. We're grateful to God for the building simply because it's the place where the people of God have met together. So let's think a little bit about what do we mean by followers of Jesus doing life together. What does that look like? What does it mean to do life together? Well, let's look at the passage from Acts chapter 2, see what it looked like for them, and I think we'll find that it looks very similar for us. And the first thing to say, and the obvious thing to say, is that doing life together involves meeting together. It's the simple, it's the most obvious, but let's not miss it out. We saw it a moment ago, didn't we? Every day, they continued to meet together in the temple courts. Now, that's quite a thought, isn't it? Every day, they continued to meet together. Not every Sunday, not every other Sunday, or every third Sunday, but every day, they continued to meet together. That's quite a high standard of membership, isn't it? If you sort of had asked, you know, Peter, so what are your four markers of membership? Well, turning up every day, that's number one. Well, it's quite a high standard, isn't it? Every day they met together in the temple courts. And the temple courts, that was a fairly big place. That's a model that has been built in Jerusalem of what the temple courts used to look like. It's a scale model. It gives something of the sense of the size of it. You could get thousands of people in the temple courts. I love Google. I love the internet because you can get any answer you want from Google. And so I Googled how many people would you fit in the temple courts. And one article that I read said you could probably get 1 million people into the temple courts. Now, I think there might have been a few issues of space and movement if you'd gone for that. And I think that's probably a little bit on the high side. And probably a more conservative estimate was that you could probably get somewhere between 300,000 and 400,000 people into the temple courts. It was a massive open space where they met. And so on that very first day of the church's history, when about 3,000 people accepted the message and were baptized and added to their number, they didn't have any problems of space. They didn't have to go, goodness me, we need a new building. They just took up a little bit more of that big, wide open space that they had. Because for them, it was important to do life together in the large public gatherings. They thought it was important. And we think so too. We may not yet be gathering the thousands who gathered in those first days in Acts 2, but Sunday by Sunday we gather like this in big public gatherings because this is a key part of doing life together. You can't do life together and not meet. But it was only about 30 years later than the events that are recorded in Acts chapter 2 that someone had to write a letter to some of those first followers of Jesus from a Jewish background. And it's a letter that made it into the New Testament, and we know it as the letter to the Hebrews. And the person who wrote that letter to those Hebrew Christians had to speak to them about not giving up meeting together as some are in the habit of doing, but encouraging one another. And so it seems that within 30 years, some people had started to make their faith a solitary thing. That then their personal faith had become a solitary. I don't need to meet. And so the writer of Hebrews said, no, you need to meet. Don't give up meeting together. He needed to remind them. He needed to challenge them. Don't stop meeting. Now, you obviously do not need to be reminded because you are here this morning. Aren't you glad that this was one of those Sundays in three that you decided to come so that you can feel, oh, made it this Sunday? So you obviously don't need to be reminded because you're here. But you may want to get a copy of the CD and give it to someone who isn't here this morning. Or you may want to recommend to someone that they listen to this, downloading it from the website. And so just for a moment, this next 30 seconds is not for you here. But if you are listening to this on CD because somebody gave you a copy of the CD, now you know why they gave it to you. Big public gatherings, meeting together is a key part of life together. But it wasn't just the big public gatherings. We also read this. They broke bread in their homes and ate together with glad and sincere hearts, praising God and enjoying the favor of all the people. So we can add another element in. What does it mean to do life together? And this is a fundamental biblical scriptural principle. Meals together is part of church life. Eating together is a key part of doing life together. If you've ever wondered, why do we serve coffee, tea, and biscuits, not just before, but during and after all our services, we are simply wanting to express this biblical principle that life together involves eating and drinking together. And it may be as simple as sharing coffee and biscuits with someone after, before, even during. We don't mind if you do it during the service, as long as you don't all do it together. We really don't mind. It could be as simple as some of you deciding after the service to take advantage of the Tie & Co. lunch deal and head up to the high road to eat together. Tie & Co. do a great lunch deal, around about a fiver, may have just tipped over the £5 mark. But I know every time I've eaten in Tie & Co. on a Sunday, on the next table, there have been people from St. Barnabas, often discussing loudly the sermon that I've just preached in very, very negative terms. And I'm not going to mention Tom and Sarah Restall, but they know who they are, and I'm still carrying the wounds from that. So it could be that you choose to do that, because eating together, it's not that that's not church, that's just church somewhere else. Or you as an 1130 congregation, of course, are famous for your international lunches, the sight of a large dish of curry speaks to the heart of the 1130 congregation, because eating together is not an incidental little unimportant extra. It's a key part of church life. The 2-4 group that I'm in meets over breakfast at the Tally Ho. We make eating together a part of life together. But let's not forget that in Acts chapter 2, they did this in their homes. All the examples I've given so far have been in public places, either here or Ty & Co. or wherever. What about in our homes? And so the 930 congregation does its thing called Plated 8, which is in people's homes. Or it may be that your missional community will decide to have a meal together in someone's home or garden. That was the La Roca missional community, a very colorful gathering, having a barbecue together last summer. So your missional community meeting together. It may be deciding to join the supper club missional community so that you can intentionally invite people to a meal in your home. Or it may be just as simple as you turning to the person next to you after the service, or the person that you find yourself speaking to after the service, and saying, "Got any plans for lunch? No? Why not come back to ours? So you two, got any plans for lunch? Come back to ours. That'd be good. Okay." That's what life together looks like. It's doing meals together, life together. Let's remind ourselves, what else? We got meetings, we got meals. What else? All the believers were together, we read, and had everything in common. They sold property and possessions to give to anyone who had need. We can add to that another passage later in Acts where we read this. All the believers were one in heart and mind. No one claimed that any of their possessions was their own, but they shared everything they had. With great power, the apostles continued to testify to the resurrection of the Lord Jesus. And God's grace was so powerfully at work in them all that there were no needy persons among them. For from time to time, those who owned land or houses sold them, brought the money from the sales, and put it at the apostles' feet, and it was distributed to anyone who had need. And there was one person who did this so significantly that he gets a special mention. And it's someone that we as a church quite like. And we read this, Joseph, a Levite from Cyprus, whom the apostles called Barnabas. We like him. We're named after him, which means son of encouragement, sold a field he owned and brought the money and put it at the apostles' feet. So we can now add another element to life together, and it is this element of money. Money is involved in life together. People sold houses and land, and they brought the money from the sales, and they put it at the disposal of the leadership of the church, who then distributed it to anyone who had need. And I think that there is something significant in the fact that Barnabas is mentioned as doing this really well, that I think there's something in the DNA of a church that is named after St. Barnabas that reflects that. Because we already do this, don't we? We do it in so many different ways. You may be someone who's already got involved in supporting the food bank, the Finchley Food Bank. You may have bought food and given food, used your money to buy food for the food bank. It may have been that last year when we took that special offering, which we sent via Tear Fund for people affected by the typhoon in the Philippines, that you gave to that. But it's not just about these one-off special things. It's also about the regular, faithful, committed, generous giving of the people of God. That's how money is involved in life together. About a week ago, I got involved in a fascinating conversation with someone who is not a member of St. Barnabas Church. And let me underline the not a member of St. Barnabas Church, lest you try and think, oh, I wonder who that was he was talking to. You do not know them. Okay, so let's establish that. And it was quite an interesting conversation about church and money and how churches deal with money and things like that. And this person said to me something like this. They said, surely you as a church don't take money from people who are on benefits. And first of all, I was able to assure him, we don't take money from anyone. We're quite clear about that. We do not take money. You may have noticed this morning, and trust every Sunday morning, that when Gladys invited the hospitality team to do something involving money, she did not ask them to take anything. She asked them to receive the offering. There's a big difference between taking something and receiving it. We will gladly receive your offerings, but we don't take anything. We will invite you to set up a standing order, but we don't have the facility for direct debit. We can't take it out of your account. So I was able to reassure this person, first of all, it is, isn't it? Yes, but no. But we don't take anything. But then I picked up on the issue that they'd spoken about, and I was able to say to them that I know that there are people in St. Barnabas who are either on benefits or on very low incomes, and we do not take anything from them, but they choose to give freely, regularly, sacrificially to the work of God here. They choose to, they want to give, even though they're on low incomes, even though they may be on benefit, they choose to give because for them it's giving to God. It's an act of worship. And then as the conversation progressed, they obviously tried to think of, well, what might be the sort of average amount that someone might give? And this person said to me, well, suppose someone gives £20 a month to your church. And I sort of stopped them. I said, okay, let me tell you about our church. I said, there are some people who give that sort of amount. I said, but there are other people, and there are lots of them, and they don't give just tens of pounds a month. They give hundreds of pounds every month to St. Barnabas. There are people who choose to give not just £20, but £200, £300, £400 a month and more to St. Barnabas. I'm quite surprised to hear that. I said, and not only that, there are some people who occasionally make one-off gifts, not of hundreds of pounds, but gifts of thousands of pounds to St. Barnabas Church. I said, this is an amazingly generous church. You see, when Paul wrote to the Christians at Thessalonica, one of the things he said to them was, you are our pride and joy. And when I'm involved in conversations like that with people outside of St. Barnabas, I can genuinely say that about you as a congregation, about us as a community. But I can say it about you. You are our pride and joy. The way in which you give to special offerings and the way in which you give regularly and sacrificially, the way that you put money in is something that causes us to say you are our pride and joy. You may not know this, but every Tuesday when the ministry leaders of this church meet, we begin our meeting with a section called Pride and Joy. And you get a mention, often by name. We just talk about you. Sorry, we talk about you behind your backs. We do. And we say, so I was talking with so-and-so this week, and I was just so blessed by their attitude about this. Or so-and-so is going through a really tough time, but they're still holding in. And we'll tell the stories about you, and we'll say, these people are our pride and joy. And because we say it about you, this morning I want to say it to you. I want to say it to your face. The way you give, the way you get that money is involved in life together, you are our pride and joy. It's a great privilege for me when I have conversations like the one I had with someone outside of the church, just to be able to talk as I did and say, this is an amazing bunch of people. They get it. Money is involved in life together. You are our pride and joy. And if I had the moment to eyeball each of you individually, I would do it that way. Hear the message. We are amazingly proud of you. Well, as you can see, we've looked at meetings, meals, and money. There's still a little bit of space at the bottom, and there's still a bit of time left, so let's add a couple of other things up there as well. What else is involved in life together? Well, let's put another one up. It was part of Acts chapter 2. It's part of us ministry together. What does that mean? Well, let's keep it simple. Ministry just means serving. That's all it means. The Latin word minister was just the ordinary everyday word for servant. So ministry is what you do when you serve. When you serve somebody, that's ministry. And the church in Acts, we read, as if you go through the book of Acts, you see how they served one another in a variety of different ways. It's quite interesting, the variety of ways in which they served. If there were Christians visiting from another area, they opened their homes and offered hospitality to people from other areas. When widows were going hungry, they organized a daily distribution of food for the widows. When people got sick, they prayed for them and healed the sick. When some of their number had death threats against them, and that happened twice in Acts chapter 9 when people tried to kill Paul, the rest of the church just organized a guard and an escape committee and they got him out of the city, and they helped him to escape. They served him very practically. In other words, ministry, serving, is just getting on and doing whatever is necessary to serve one another. That's what ministry is. And we as a church want to follow their example. We want to be a community of people where the attitude is just, we just get on and do what needs to be done to serve one another. And there are so many ways that you can do that. Henry talked about it earlier, didn't he, when he was talking about the markers of membership. And you've probably spotted that this sermon is basically just markers of membership dressed up a little bit differently. So it's the same thing. But there are so many ways in which you can serve. You can serve on hospitality teams. You can serve on a prayer ministry team. Now, we don't often need people to organize escape committees for staff members who are getting death threats, but we do occasionally need people to do some setup and clear up after events. And we sometimes need people to film events that go on outside the building. We need people to help with transport for seniors for a Wednesday club. And at the moment, we've got a couple of areas where we really need some people to get involved. The trouble is, they require some very specialist skills. And that you may find that you're excluded because of the specialist skills. The first thing is, we need some people with a very specialist skill of being able to drink coffee. I know it's setting the bar high. It's a high bar, but we really do need people who can drink coffee. Not just because we enjoy drinking coffee, but things like Finchley Jam Missional Community, which meets on the third Thursday of every month, 20th of March, this Thursday they'll be meeting up there on the High Road in Coffee Republic. They don't just want people who will turn up and get involved in the music, the singing and the playing. They want folks who will be there to be part of the crowd, part of the audience, who will sit there and drink coffee and hopefully talk to the people next to them as well, who will just be ordinary people. So we need this specialist skill of ordinary people who know how to drink coffee. And that could be your ministry. You could have a ministry of coffee drinking. Now, the next one, the bars, again, it's quite high. We need people who have the specialist skill of being able to speak English. Again, I know we're really pushing the bar, we're really going high, but we do need people who can speak English. Because now we've got the English Cafe meeting at 2 o'clock on a Sunday, again in Coffee Republic, where people from other countries who want to improve their English just want to come along and talk to someone who can speak English. And if you could speak English and drink coffee, wow, you are just in that top echelon of people that we're really looking for to get involved in serving. You can serve someone from another country just by going along and speaking English to them to help them develop their English. I didn't say you had to be able to teach it. You just need to be able to speak it. Because that's what life together is about. It's looking for all the different ways that we can serve one another and the community, and then getting on and doing them. So life together involves ministry. So, what else? Well, come back to the title of the sermon. The question was, what and why is the church? Well, we've looked at the what. Church is Christians doing life together. What's the why? Why are we here? And the answer is this. We meet together. We have meals together, we share money together, and we do ministry together for one very simple reason, and it is because we are on mission together. Mission is what it's all about. Now, this is familiar territory. You've heard this so many times, but let me just underline it and remind you again. At St. Bees, we talk a lot about mission. We have our mission task force. We prayed for John and Susie Peachy during our prayers, who are mission partners. And we've got other mission partners around the country and around the world. So when we're doing mission at a distance, we do it through our mission task force. When we're doing mission locally, we do it through our missional communities. Because whether it's at a distance or at home, we're involved in mission. Last Sunday was our annual general meeting, and Henry reminded us that one of our key strategies for this year on the card is this, to boldly pursue mission in everything. That's what we are about as a church, mission. Why do we make such a big thing about mission? The answer to that question is very simple, Because Jesus told us to. It's what Jesus said. In John's Gospel, we read that the first thing that Jesus said to his disciples after he was raised from the dead, the first thing he said to them was this, "As the Father has sent me, so I am sending you." Mission. In Matthew's Gospel, we find out that a little while later, Jesus got his disciples together in Galilee, and there he told them, "Go and make disciples of all nations." Mission. And in the book of Acts, Luke tells us that just before Jesus ascended into heaven, he said to his disciples, "You will be my witnesses in Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, to the ends of the earth." Mission. Jesus was making sure that they understood and that we understand that mission is why we exist. In that sense, mission shouldn't just be one of those little circles. It should be an all-embracing circle. Everything else that we do because we are involved in mission. And they did mission together. When you read through the book of Acts, one of the things that strikes you is that these first followers of Jesus hardly ever did mission alone. There were one or two occasions where they did it alone, but that was not the norm. They did mission together. I remember when I was in Bible college, the principal at the time, Gilbert Kirby, saying to us, "Remember," he said, "cranks work alone." And that's a sobering word, you know, cranks work alone. So if you're doing it by yourself, there's a reasonable possibility that people will think you're a crank, whether you are or not. But whole people work together, and they did mission together. On the day of Pentecost, when Peter stood up, he didn't stand up alone. We read they were all together, and then Peter stood up with the 11. They were all there in this work of mission. The next chapter, it's Peter and John who are going to the temple where they encounter the lame man who got healed. When the church in Antioch began to reach out to the nations around them, it was Barnabas and Saul, and John Mark as well, that they sent out together. And on one of the few occasions where Paul found himself alone, because there'd been more death threats against him in Berea, and they'd had to organize another escape committee and get into Athens, and so a group of Christians from Berea escorted Paul to Athens and left him there all by himself, he just said to them, just get Silas and Timothy to join me as quickly as possible. He sent the message back with them, "I don't want to work alone." Mission in the New Testament is something that we do together. So as a church, we aim to do mission together through our missional communities. Because we do mission, they're missional communities. Because we do mission together, they're missional communities. As that very subtle poster on the wall says over there, we believe in mission and community. It's both together. We want to do mission together. Now, next Sunday, we'll begin to be talking a little bit more about what's going to be happening over Easter. And let me just give you a sneak preview of our Easter publicity, and you'll get the cards of things that will be happening over Easter. Some of these will be missional events. All of these, if it will be missional events that you can invite people to. There's something on Maundy Thursday, something on Good Friday, and there's something on Easter Day. And when you get the card, you may well look at it and go, Thursday, Friday, Sunday, what happened to Saturday? Because usually on the Saturday between Good Friday and Easter Sunday, and nobody knows quite what to call that Saturday, because it's not technically Easter Saturday, because that's the following Saturday. And so we call it the Saturday between Good Friday and Easter Sunday, and then we're clear what we're talking about. On that Saturday between Good Friday and Easter Sunday, surely we usually go up on the high road, don't we? We've had those big events up on the high road. Well, this year, we're not going to do that. We decided to do something radically different this year. And what we've decided this year is instead of doing something on the high road, we're going to ask and encourage all of our missional communities to do something on that Saturday. That's the Saturday between Good Friday and Easter Sunday, which will actually be the 19th of April. And rather than spend the money on what we would have done on the high road, we're going to make that money available to our missional communities to say, what could you do that would be an outreach type event where you can just do something that will bring you into contact with people who are not yet part of the church and maybe have a meal with them or share Jesus with them in some way. So we're wanting to do mission differently on the Saturday. We'll have the big events here, the Friday and the Sunday, but on the Saturday, rather than do the big public, we want to do it through our missional communities. We want mission to be happening everywhere. So you'll be hearing more about that through your missional community leaders. and missional community leaders, if you're thinking, that's the first I've heard of it, you should have checked your emails last night, because I did send you an email last night telling you about that so that you wouldn't hear it first from me in public. But if you didn't check your emails, my apologies, I didn't get that out sooner, if that came as a surprise to you as a missional community leader. But if you're not yet in a missional community, that would be a great opportunity for you to get involved, wouldn't it? Just to see that Saturday is a day that you could get involved. Lots of events where we can do mission together. So, it's time to wrap up. We've got meetings, meals, money, ministry, mission. That's what church is, and that's why church is. Mission is why we exist. That's what the past 100 years in this building have been about. It's been about doing those things. And by the grace of God, unless Jesus comes back in the meantime, that's what the next 100 years will be about. It may happen for a little while longer here in this building, because as we heard this morning, we didn't yet get the building that we want to get. So we may be here a little longer than we anticipated being here. But actually, you may have noticed that none of those things require us to be in this building or in any other particular building. We can do those whether we have this building, no building, or any other building. These are the things that church is about. It's life together that is not dependent on a building. And so, by the grace of God, that's what the next 100 years will be about. Keeping on doing these things.